The campfire is 100% contained, but the tragedy is far from over, and cleanup continues to happen across Butte County. We'll get an update on the current conditions from CAL FIRE Chief Mike Muller. Also, many survivors of the fire that destroyed the town of Paradise and displaced more than 50,000 people are in urgent need of medical care. A team of healthcare providers from UC Davis have been volunteering their time to take care of the evacuees. We'll explain what they're treating. Then, a new climate report spells out dire consequences for the U.S. economy, including more devastating wildfires in the future. Political junkie Ken Rudin has analysis. And Cities You Wish You Were From are back from touring on their new record, and they're playing two local shows soon. We'll revisit their live acoustic performance from September. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Duncan, filling in for Beth Ruyak, who returns next Monday. Rainstorms over the holiday weekend helped firefighters gain the upper hand in what has become the state's deadliest wildfire. The Camp Fire, which started November 8th in Butte County and devastated the town of Paradise and the surrounding community, is 100% contained. Joining us to help explain what that actually means is CAL FIRE spokesman Mike Muller. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
So CAL FIRE did announce on Sunday yesterday that the Camp Fire was contained. But what does that really mean? Because the fire is not out, we know. Are we looking for a lot of firefighters to be leaving the area? What is the next step?
Yeah, no, absolutely. The rain definitely helped. And when we say 100% containment, that means we physically have a line all the way around the fire that is, you know, securing any type of burn that may be on the interior of the fire. And then again, with the significant amount of rainfall, knocked down a lot of the hot spots. So at this point, yes, a lot of resources are going to be released. And now, unfortunately, we start into the recovery process.
So at this point, do you feel comfortable that everything is pretty much under control? You're not too concerned about that fire flaring up again?
No, we're very confident. We have what we call tactical patrols that are still out in the within the fire perimeter, just patrolling to make sure there are no hot spots. But we are confident with the 100% containment.
There was concern about the series of winter storms that moved through the region last week and how that might affect recovery efforts. How did that end up playing out, and is it still a concern?
It is. When we talk about recovery, unfortunately, we still have people that haven't been accounted for. Anytime you have that type of weather, it slows the operation down. But we've brought in additional, through the Sheriff's Department, law enforcement officers to go ahead with that operation. But yes, it definitely has an impact and slows the process.
Were there any serious slides or mud flows or water issues from the storms that we had recently?
No, and the way that these storms were broken up, it worked out that we have what we call some ash flows from some of the destroyed properties, but as far as major mud flows or any type of landslides, we did not experience that just because the storms were spaced out. But we also have watershed emergency response team members that will continue to be out in the field to sustain and build up those hillsides that have been denuded by the fire.
So that could be a concern if we got hit with a series of storms down the road here a bit.
Absolutely, that the watershed repair will continue for several months.
What are the top issues right now that your crews are facing as you get into another phase of this fire?
Well, I think right now it's for the fire, the actual operations is assisting law enforcement with the recovery operations, but also the department, California Department Office of Emergency Services, the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, will now move forward into the recovery process as far as removing debris and getting that neighborhood or that area, hopefully, within the recovery process back to somewhat of normalcy.
Do you know of the houses that weren't destroyed but are surrounded by destroyed homes? Are those inhabitable? Can people go back there once they have some electricity?
Well, there's going to be a lot of it may not have significant what we would call structural damage, but just the amount of smoke, as your listeners know, we sat in that smoke for weeks on end, and those homes were right in the middle of it. So there's going to be some repairs that are going to have to be done due to smoke damage and maybe some minor infrastructure. So they still have a long way to go, even the structures that did survive.
Do we have any timeline on when those structures would allow people to have some electricity power there so they can actually do some work?
I don't. I can tell you the utility companies, that's their first priority in getting infrastructure and standing that back up so people can get back to their homes with the normal utilities.
And just looking at your week ahead, what are your priorities like right now?
I think our priorities right now are again, is making sure that the communities are safe for people to enter and traverse those areas. But also, you know, again, working with the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, they will move forward with the recovery process. And then also monitoring the weather. We're looking at several more rainstorms and working closely with the Watershed Emergency Response Team to set up infrastructure so we do not have those large mud flows.
And how about trees that are still standing but that might be damaged? Our listeners heard from NPR about problems of dead and damaged or dying trees throughout the area.
No, there are. We have crews out there surveying trees and taking down ones that are what we would consider hazards. But then we also want to remind the public that goes into that area to be cognizant, because there are several hundred trees that have been weakened by this fire. And crews will go through and survey those and remove the hazard trees.
Are you hearing any stories personally about any additional animals or pets that have surfaced in all of this devastation and in after the initial find, but now?
No, I have not, but we do recommend if someone does find an animal to take to the local animal shelter and hopefully get reunited with their family, but we have not heard of that.
Okay. Let's turn to Southern California. I'm talking with CAL FIRE's Deputy Director of Communications, Michael Mueller. Can you get us up to speed on what's happening in the southern part of our state with fires?
Well, everything in the southern part of the state is also 100% contained. Unfortunately, it looks like this week ahead in Southern California, what the weather models are showing are possible fire weather watches and red flag warnings for maybe some Santa Ana wind events, which we'll be monitoring very closely.
All righty, Chief Mueller, we really appreciate you taking the time out this morning to be with us. Have a great rest of your week. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You can find more information about the Camp Fire, including links and resources on how to help evacuees, on our website, capradio.org/insight. I'm Beth Duncan. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Welcome back to Insight with Beth Ruyak on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak. Survivors of the Camp Fire are in urgent need of medical care. Groups of doctors, nurses, and students from UC Davis Health are volunteering their time in Butte County, where they are treating thousands of evacuees for everything from wounds and asthma to the norovirus that has broken out at some shelters. Joining us in studio today is Anthony F. Durant. He is the chair of the Department of Family and Community Medicine at UC Davis Health. Tony, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Also joining us today is Shannon Watson. Shannon is a student in the Physician Assistant Program at UC. She's also a registered nurse, a public health nurse, and a longtime disaster relief volunteer and former Butte County resident as well. Shannon, welcome.
Thank you.
Tony, starting with you, tell us about the challenges of setting up an emergency medical care center right in the middle of a disaster area. You know, sometimes it's a gym or a church or a parking lot. How do you do that?
Well, Shannon's actually very well positioned to describe some more about that, but I would say that it's a huge undertaking. It's obviously always happening at a time of great chaos. There are physical challenges, and I think the biggest challenges are human challenges. You know, these are the local community physicians and healthcare workers were also affected by this fire. So you need to mobilize people from all over the region. And that's one of the reasons why UC Davis has been very much wanting to be involved and being and has been involved with this effort.
Shannon, for a lot of people, that would be overwhelming. How do you begin to organize and get something like that set up?
It's incredibly hard. The people that are setting up these shelters, aside from Red Cross and public health, these pop-up shelters specifically, are people that have lost their homes themselves. So they have just faced a crisis and in that have to immediately turn around to take care of their community and these patients and then mobilize setting up a clinic, which means calling churches, calling places where there's a gymnasium to use, mobilizing the medical resources, making sure that there's food, that there's clothing, that there's donations, that there's volunteers, that it's an entire process.
And Tony, which evacuees are being treated? There was a lot of people that have left, have found other places to be, but many that have not. So which evacuees are under your care?
Right. Well, so there's people that are, they have illnesses, but they're not necessarily sick enough to be in the hospital, which of course is overwhelmed in that area, or we're not sick enough to need to be evacuated here to the medical center. So it includes people with chronic conditions, many of them things like diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. They're folks who were cut off from their medications when they experienced the fire. Fortunately, there have been the local hospital has been donating medications and supplies, and others have been bringing in supplies. But they need to be have these medicines administered. They need to have their blood pressure monitored. There is some minor wound care. There has been outbreaks also of illnesses such as norovirus, which is an intestinal bug that requires often IV fluids. So there's lots of different needs. And the key thing to emphasize is these are going to be ongoing for quite a while for many of these folks because they don't have a lot of resources and they're going to rely on volunteers and volunteer efforts to be able to get by this difficult period.
The norovirus, highly contagious. How do you isolate people in a situation like that?
Well, I think that you do the best you can, and what some of our physicians who have been up and back have been saying is that initially it was a little rocky, but they gradually start to get those folks isolated in one section of the shelter. They start to use, make sure everybody's using good sterile, technique or at least hand washing technique to prevent spread. And again, IV fluids and keeping people hydrated is one of the key things, especially older folks that can be very, very dangerous if they get dehydrated.
Shannon, the campfire disaster must be especially personal for you since you are from Butte County.
Yes.
So what prompted you to become a part of this effort and what is the culture of that environment like now as people are struggling?
Well, my prompt first came from Red Cross when I got the call because the wildfire had broken out. So early Thursday morning, Red Cross contacted me and said, we need nurses up here. And I was not able to go that day. And so I had to go over the weekend. And I had received a call from some fellow nurses that I used to work with at Feather River Hospital. And they said, we have a lot of patients that need medical care. We're going to start our own pop-up shelter clinic. Mm-hmm. There's 250 people here. Can you come? Of course. That is the community that raised me to be a nurse. It's the community that taught me what emergency response truly is, and it was just instinctual. I needed to be there.
And you've served in other disaster areas, so tell me, how does this one differ from the other situations that you have served in and have helped take care of people?
This differs in the population that it affected and the scale that it affected. There is not going to be an end to this. Just because the fire is out, this is not over. There are many, many people missing still. There are many who lost their lives. And the town itself is going to be extremely hard to rebuild if that's possible. And so the magnitude of this disaster is just unprecedented. It's not like anything I've ever seen before.
Do you think Paradise will be paradise again?
With the response that's come out of the community, potentially. That is the part that I can take hope in. It will be a long time before that is a viable option, however.
I'm talking with Anthony F. Durant. He is the chair of the Department of Family and Community Medicine at UC Davis Health, and Shannon Watson, a student in the Physician Assistant Program at UC. And we're talking, of course, about the health of campfire survivors. Tony, how do you go about signing up volunteers, and how do you make sure that they are the right people to be in that situation?
Right. Well, at a local level, we have, through the department chairs and our vice chancellor and dean, we've been putting out the word to mobilize clinicians from UC Davis. And I should say that not only has it been wonderful, the response from clinicians that want to go up there and have been up there in many cases, but also people making accommodations to allow that to happen, people working double shifts or people covering other people's clinics, those types of things to allow that to happen. As far as the vetting effort, that has been happening up there where the Red Cross and the Public Health Department and others have been making sure that, for example, these are licensed physicians who are qualified to take care of patients. We've been focusing on primary care clinicians in particular, because, such as from my own department, because they are broadly trained. They're able to do lots of different things. However, there is an emerging, I think, serious need for mental health care, some of it which will go beyond the general mental health care training that we have had as family physicians. And I think that's going to be a really important need as people sort of fully process what has happened. There'll be PTSD and other issues that psychiatrists, I think, and other mental health professionals will be very important. Shannon was also mentioning an emerging need for social workers as well, because people are now at that stage of what am I going to do going forward. So it's a matter of knowing what the common problems are that you see in a disaster situation like this, and making sure that the clinicians you have up there are able to provide those, meet those needs. Excuse me.
And how does this all relate to community medicine? Does it have to do with the fact that some of those people who've lost everything are in those fields of mental health and psychology and social work?
Yeah, that's sort of what earlier on, as I mentioned, you know, that there is now apparently some mobilization of the local healthcare providers in the area, but obviously they were reeling initially as well, and many have lost what they had. And so that's, again, why I think a regional response and really a statewide response is so important to these types of disasters, because this is a time when people in the community need to focus on getting well themselves, ideally.
Shannon, you bring with you a special set of skills, administrative skills, and you've been able to locate people who were listed as missing. Can you talk a little bit about that, what your approach is to that very sensitive assignment?
Yeah, so I also want to point out that the only reason I was really able to do that was because we had had enough nursing coverage that day that allowed me that time. So the volunteer aspect was crucial in giving me the ability to then go take care of the missing list. I pulled together a team, and we sat in a room for probably about 7 hours and pored over thousands of names. Everyone who had come into the shelter, who had stopped by as a visitor, that we had had a note on, we checked medical records, and I cross-checked every single name that we had, including nicknames, misspellings, etc., and in doing so was able to locate 12 of the missing.
In this process, are you also finding people on that list were previously deceased? Their families didn't realize it, but, you know, their grandmother or whomever died and they were not aware, as well as obviously victims of that fire. But I'm sure there's a lot of things that you're finding when you're looking at names of people that are missing.
There are. And that is not one that I've come across myself, but that I have heard of happening. There's reasons across the board for people that are listed on the missing list. And some will turn up inevitably in shelters and have fled somewhere.
Sure.
And they just haven't contacted anyone. But yes, some are deceased. And yeah.
And do you get information from people, they might be friends or relatives, that have kind of been living off the grid? It's a very rural area. And so it's a very difficult situation to really track them down, because they weren't really part of perhaps the community in that way.
Absolutely. For example, I had a woman at the shelter who we had been interacting with for an entire week. I knew her name and that she was there. I just never knew that she was on the missing list. And come to find out, when I had asked her why she hadn't contacted family, it was because she had never owned a cell phone before and she didn't know how to use it. She was given one from AT&T in this crisis. They had pulled up a van and given her one to use, and she didn't know how to unlock the phone screen because that's we're dealing with an elderly population who is not skilled in using mobile devices. This is kind of a new problem.
Not a high-tech group.
Exactly.
In some cases. Well, Shannon and Tony, I think you both have addressed this a little bit, but if we could go just a little bit deeper, can we talk about the short-term crisis versus the long-term healthcare issues? And as you said, this is a long recovery process. I mean, there's nothing left for so many people. So how do you go about this now in terms of what's going to be happening 6 months now from now or a year from now? Tony, would you like to start?
Right. Well, I think the key is, again, to continue to get the word out regionally and across the state, because I think there is a natural tendency that once this inevitably starts to fade a little bit from the news, there's this feeling that it's taken care of. But that is actually, we were talking a little bit before the show, one of the most difficult parts of any recovery effort, because people can then be out of mind. So I think it is making sure that, for example, in our health system and others, that we keep this at the top of our list of important things, that we continue to make sure that we check in with people in Butte County and try to meet their needs for volunteers, not just in the first few days, but over the next weeks and probably months. And that will take more than just our health system, by the way. I think it needs to be a very broad effort with all people that and systems that provide healthcare contributing.
Shannon.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. The need for surrounding communities to step up to help this community is essential. As time goes on, they aren't going to have primary care docs to go back to. They're not going to have the hospital to go back to. They're not going to have their typical community resources that they were used to, right? If they go to dialysis every week and the dialysis center burned, how are they going to meet that need in the next 6 months? So things like that are what we have to start gearing towards addressing and mobilizing volunteers here to help meet that need up there so that Butte County and the medical professionals there and the volunteers there on the ground aren't so overwhelmed as really needed.
A lot of record keeping. So you can do follow-up on individuals, a lot of individuals, a lot of people. Is that proving to be a difficult task?
I think the key is you in a situation like this, you tend to provide the care, and the documentation does sometimes come second. I would imagine there is a lot of challenge in making sure, though, that there's a good documentation trail. And that should get a little bit easier and more systematic once that is one thing about the immediate crisis being over. There's a little bit more time to think about those kinds of things. But first and foremost is providing the care.
I know this is not specifically your area, but of course a critical issue is housing. Any indication of where these folks may go?
I have seen many of them be absorbed, obviously, into the surrounding areas. Red Bluff, Redding, Chico, Oroville, Yuba City, places like that. They are going also places like Auburn, so a little bit further. But there are some people that are taking this opportunity to just up and leave. They don't want to go back. They don't want to rebuild. There's a lot of trauma there, and they would rather start over somewhere new. So I've heard of some going out of state, maybe moving somewhere they've always wanted to go, and they're kind of taking this opportunity to do that.
And that might be, too, because of the age of the population. A lot of people retired to Paradise.
Exactly.
To enjoy the lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So they'll be looking for something different, perhaps.
Yeah.
I appreciate both of you being with us today, and thank you for your efforts up there in helping these people that are really struggling. You are listening to Anthony F. Durant. He is, again, the chair of the Department of Family and Community Medicine at UC Davis Health, and Shannon Watson. She's a student in the Physician Assistant Program at UC Davis. She's also a registered nurse and a very committed disaster relief worker. So we thank you both for being on Insight today. And we have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak. Last Friday, the federal government published a major report on climate change that was all but buried by the Thanksgiving holiday. The latest from the National Climate Assessment paints a dire picture for the U.S. economy in face of the global climate change, including an increase in devastating and deadly wildfires like the one in Butte County. And it runs counter to much of what the Trump administration has been proclaiming. Joining us today to dissect it all, political junkie Ken Rudin. Hi, Ken.
Good morning, Beth. I mean Beth.
The other Beth.
Right, the other Beth.
Ken, good morning. This latest report is something else. I mean, it's a huge deal. I'm not sure how many people read it over the weekend.
Of course, you make a very good point. It was almost buried by being delivered the day after Thanksgiving for a Saturday newspaper that most people don't get Saturday newspapers. The administration did everything it can to bury the news, but the news is big, considering the fact that there are very dire economic and environmental risks to what's going on with climate change. And these are things, of course, that the Trump administration has either poo-pooed or ignored for the past 2 years.
One thing that caught my eye when I read it were the dates. We're talking about the 2022?
Right, or the end of the century, which is about 81, 82 years from now when you and I will be in our, I guess, 90s or so. But I mean, but it's much closer than we expect, because they're talking about that what the consequences of climate change, which, as I said, the Trump administration has kind of poo-pooed for the past 2 years. 10% of the U.S. economy would be hard hit by what's going on with the economy, with the environment and the climate. And so we're talking about what's going on with the horrific fires in California and the crop failures in the Midwest and the floods in the Southeast and all that's going on. And we're talking about, is it only going to get worse, which is the most remarkable thing about this is this was put out by a government that basically, you know, argues that pollution isn't so terrible, that more car emissions and more power plants and more coal emissions are not the worst thing in the world. And if anything, they'll help the economy. So you have a government that doesn't believe in climate change, at the same time reading a report that shows dire risks to the economy and to the health of the country and to the environment of the country by century's end.
Was there any official response from the administration?
Nothing I saw. You know, nothing I saw. I mean, of course, this came out Saturday morning. I haven't seen anything today. I know the president today is leaving for a campaign trip to Mississippi in advance of tomorrow's Senate race there. And we could talk about that as well. But I have not seen anything. The only thing I've seen is from scientists who say that this is really, really important stuff and serious stuff, and we ignore it at our peril. And yet you still have a government that talks about taking the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement, you know, regarding carbon emissions. And so it seems like everybody realizes the importance and how crucial this report is, except for the folks who are running the government.
So, Ken, next subject, Nancy Pelosi. Let's talk about her whipping votes and bargaining. She's made inroads with younger House members by offering them apparently newly created spots in the leadership. What is the latest on that scene?
Well, you know, something that's interesting. We know that a lot of Democrats who were running for election in this year's election, especially in more conservative red states, red districts, said they would under no circumstances vote for Nancy Pelosi for Speaker, and not because she's 78 years old, not because she's been in the leadership for 15 years, but she is a favorite Republican target. They love to run against her. But if Nancy Pelosi were so toxic, so politically toxic, as some people were claiming, would the Democrats have done as well as they did on November 6th and the days after with all the subsequent recounts and victories? The Democrats look like they picked up anywhere between 38 and 40, a net gain of 38 to 40 House seats with Nancy Pelosi in charge. So, you know, me thinks that the threat to her to her political future is overrated, especially what happened this week. We saw, I guess it was last Sunday, maybe it was last Sunday, that some 16 Democrats signed a petition saying they will not vote for Pelosi under any circumstances. The one Democrat who was thinking of running against her, Marcia Fudge, a Democrat from Cleveland, has since said that because Nancy Pelosi promised her certain things like about vote suppression and minority voting and things like that, she will now support Pelosi for Speaker. Brian Higgins, who's a Democrat from Buffalo, New York, said that just a few days ago that, and he was one of the 16 who signed the petition. He was also promised some things from Pelosi, and he said he too will now support her bid for Speaker. So whatever you want to say about Nancy Pelosi, whatever criticisms there are about her, and there have been quite a few, nobody can ever underestimate her power, her willingness to deal, her ability to deal. And for that reason alone, I think she will be the next Speaker of the House.
So there's not very many holdouts left, is what you're telling me.
Well, the number is getting fewer and fewer. And again, even those who didn't sign the petition, those who promised not to vote for her, they may not vote for her. But there are two elections coming up. There's one this week within the Democratic caucus. And maybe those Democrats will be free to vote for somebody else or not vote for her. And then when she will become the Democratic, so-called Democratic nominee for Speaker, and the vote is between her and Kevin McCarthy on January 3rd, when the new Congress comes back, well, these Democrats could say, look, I fulfilled my obligation. I voted for against her in committee, you know, in conference among the Democrats. She's now our nominee and I will support her. So I think this week it's interesting that big opposition that once upon a time these renegades were talking about has really fizzled to maybe a dozen or so. I mean, there may be some more who vote against her, but again, I don't think her path to the speakership or her return path to the speakership is in jeopardy.
Turning to the caravan news, the caravan issue was kind of knocked off the front page for a short time, but the U.S. closed a major border crossing at San Ysidro over the weekend. There is a stretch of unfenced border separating U.S. California and Baja California a few miles inland. What can you tell me about what's happening with that?
Well, it was in the front page news, Beth, because Donald President Trump wanted it to be a campaign issue, and he tried to fire up his base by saying that, you know, the M13s and the gangs and the Muslims are coming to invade the country from the south, going through Mexico, from Central America through Mexico into California. So it was exciting. Once the election was over, we didn't hear anything. But now that many of these migrants have reached or come close to the border with the United States, there is more and more, I guess, you know, efforts for confrontation. And then we saw some confrontation over the weekend when several dozen or some 300 people, I don't know exact number, try to evade the Mexican police and storm the border and try to get through around, you know, into San Diego. And the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol police fired tear gas at these protesters and it dispersed the crowd. But, you know, the thought of, I mean, Donald Trump will talk about these murderers and rapists and gangsters and criminals who were trying to breach our borders. And many of the photographs we saw were just, you know, mothers and their children, their barefoot children, some wearing nothing more than T-shirts and diapers, were being dispersed by tear gas. So it's right now it's an uncertain future what happens to these people. But what it looks like that, you know, in the attempt to shut the border, which they did for several hours, it seems like that a lot of these migrants will just have to stay in Mexico and wait their turn to apply for asylum in the U.S., which they're allowed to do. As a matter of fact, law says they're certainly allowed to do it, but Donald Trump will do everything he can to stall the process or make it more difficult than ever.
It's going to be a long-term story for sure. Ken, let's switch gears one more time as we have a few more minutes. Senator Kamala Harris's seat on the Senate Judiciary Committee might be in jeopardy as the GOP expands their majority. Can you address that for us?
Well, this is what happened. Look, the Republicans picked up a net gain of 2 seats in the Senate. So therefore, the committee ratios can change. They may be able to gain a seat. The Republicans gain a seat on committees such as the Senate Judiciary Committee. And when they do that, the Democrats would lose a seat. The most junior member of the Senate Judiciary Committee is one of its rising stars, Kamala Harris, who certainly has 2020 presidential ambitions. And she, according to many people, was the star Democrat in the Kavanaugh hearing. So it's very possible that she would be forced off the committee unless she can convince Mitch McConnell to expand the committee to allow her to stay, which is very unlikely to happen, or if she can convince a more senior Democrat to leave the committee and move on to some other committee so she can stay on. Now, there's no guarantee that she'll be forced off, but even if she is forced off, look, everybody knows who Kamala Harris is. I don't think she has to be on the Judiciary Committee to make a difference, make an impact in politics. But given the fact that we're going to probably have a contentious debate over the next Attorney General's confirmation, perhaps another Supreme Court justice nomination in the upcoming future, Judiciary Committee is the place to be. And again, for those who think that Kamala Harris has a national ambitions in front of her, perhaps as early as 2020, that's the way she would want to be. But if she's forced off, that's just politics as usual.
All righty, Ken. Good to talk with you. Happy holidays to you.
To you too, Beth. And thanks for being the new Beth. Are you the good Beth or the bad Beth? You know, there's always good cops and bad cops. I want to know who the good Beth is and the evil Beth is.
That's yet to be decided, Ken.
Okay, gotcha. Sorry.
That is political junkie Ken Rudin. Thank you, Ken, for being on Insight. We have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak. Sacramento rock duo Cities You Wish You Were From released their debut full-length album, CYWYWF, LP 2018, in September. And they will perform live Saturday, December 1st at Goldfield Trading Post as part of a special benefit show with Hot Water Music and Kevin Seconds. They're also headlining the Merry Krampus Show at the Hideaway Bar and Grill on December 15th. Guitarist Eli Jenkins and drummer Tyler Downey came to the Insight Studios this past September to debut the single Knife and Agenda and perform an acoustic version of the fan favorite song Arkansas. Beth Ruyak began the conversation by asking why they went back into the studio to make a full-length album right after releasing an EP.
I think it was an intent to finish this album while people were still interested in us finishing an album. And then the momentum just sort of started to roll from there. We got some interest from a management company, and then we started getting offers for bigger supporting shows. And it's just sort of built from there. And then one day we woke up, and I think it was in the course of a week, we went from having like 40, 50 followers on Spotify to thousands. We're not entirely sure what's happening yet, but we're really excited about it.
Oh, somebody picked up on your music.
Somebody
is.
We got added to playlists or something.
Something happened.
An algorithm. It has gotten probably bigger and more aggressive, more energetic. But we were just talking about this on the way over here. We're doing some stuff musically that's a little bit more difficult, but the song Knife and Agenda that's sort of taking off on Spotify and iTunes right now is really straightforward, easily digestible, straight-ahead rock and roll music.
Well, I think with this record specifically, we set out to make a really dynamic sound. We wanted to have a progression within not only the album, but the individual songs themselves. And I think that comes through on a lot of those tracks. And so, like Elijah was saying, they're a little bit more accessible, a little bit more digestible. There are periods where it's really aggressive and intense, but there are other times with that song in particular where it sounds like almost something totally different.
Let's listen to a little bit of music and then we'll talk more.
You got a knife and an agenda.
Elijah Jenkins and Tyler Downey, the duo known as Cities You Wish You Were From, you are performing a song titled Arkansas. Who wrote that song, or was that a co-writing effort?
I wrote that song, gosh, now probably about 4 or 5 years ago. It's one of our softer, more Americana songs, but for a long time it probably still is one of the most popular songs that people request live. I wrote it right after getting divorced from my kid's mom. And so I think people relate. Everybody's lost something.
Mm.
So people
kind of hook into
that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To be identifying that and looking for a language for it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, I think that song is probably the song that I've touched the least as far as our songwriting process goes. But it still translates to my life and to my family's life. And so when we made the video for that, it's you know, video of our kids. And so there's backstories and stuff that we won't talk about now. But obviously it's a song that we can't not play when we're playing live, because so many people love that song. But also it means so much to us, too.
That's the kind of life experience and music that really binds people in general, but a band. What difference has it made for you two to experience your lives evolving and going through those growing up experiences together?
I tell people we're a very sort of mature band, because Tyler and I talk about everything, not just about music. We know the intricacies of each other's lives, and we're very good about calling each other out and keeping each other healthy, which is important when you're working so hard, so many hours all the time. And we have a lot of respect for what we need to get done outside of rehearsal and recording, because maintaining our families is the way that we maintain sanity. If I didn't have an intact home and a healthy son to come home to, it wouldn't make any of this worth it.
Well, yeah, and it sort of puts everything in perspective, because when we're on the road, it's tough to be away from our families, but we also use it as a time to recharge our batteries and to appreciate that experience that not a lot of dads get to do, you know? So when we come back, I think I feel, you know, ready to tackle whatever my 2-year-old can throw at me.
Exactly.
Let's listen. This is Arkansas.
Gravity's coming. Is this the place that we thought we'd be? Wonderful summer, vodka and cards while we're young and free. Oh, Arkansas, why can't you hear me? This train is coming home. Oh, Arkansas, we'll be together if it means always alone. You weren't the hard one, I steered the path and then led you there. Losing each other faster than you were ever losing hair. Oh, Arkansas, we were in London dreaming of being home. Oh, Arkansas, we'll stay together, it's just the way it was done. Together Maybe we'll make him in newer ways. Our little baby shouldn't have to struggle through southern days. Oh, Arkansas, why can't you hear me? This train is coming home. Oh, Arkansas. Oh, Arkansas.
That's Eli Jenkins and Tyler Downey. Together, they are Cities You Wish You Were From, and their self-titled full-length album is now available. You can see them perform live this Saturday, December 1st, at Goldfields in Sacramento for a special acoustic benefit show. And they're also playing at the Hideaway Bar and Grill, Mary Krampus Show on December 15th with Shotgun Sawyer, Sparks, Across Darkness, and Vinny Guidera and the Deadbirds. You can find more info, including a video of the band performing Arkansas live in the Insight studio. That is Insight for today. I'm Beth Duncan. Insight is produced by Jen Picard, Bert Johnson, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer is Matt Piscini. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back with another live show tomorrow. Thank you for joining us.